From SBR News, this is Inland Journal. I'm Doug Nadvornik. In August, residents of Spokane's West Plains will vote whether to create an aquifer protection district for their source of drinking water. It comes at a time when some of that water is contaminated with the chemicals known as PFAS. We'll talk with Ben Bradabo from Spokane County about the August ballot measure. We'll also spend a few minutes reviewing the wide range of PFAS-related projects that are ongoing on the West Plains. And Providence has announced changes in who will provide mental health services. We'll talk with Tamara Sheehan from Providence about why those changes were made and how they will affect patients. Join us for those conversations today on Inland Journal. In August, voters on the West Plains will decide whether to tax themselves to protect their source of drinking water. The ballot measure proposes to create the West Plains Aquifer Protection Area.
Counties are able to form aquifer protection areas to collect money to do activities related to protecting groundwater within a certain area. And so we've had the Spokane Valley Rathdrum Prairie Aquifer Protection Area for a number of years. And there's been a lot of attention recently on the West Plains water quality and water quantity. There's discussion about how much water is available in the West Plains for continued use.
That's Ben Bradabo. He's the Water Programs Administrator for Spokane County. The Spokane Rathdrum Prairie Aquifer Protection Area imposes a small property tax on people and businesses that draw water and expel their waste products. Last year, nearly three-fourths of voters within its boundaries agreed to reauthorize the tax for another 20 years. The West Plains Aquifer Protection Area would operate in the same way.
The proposed West Plains Aquifer Protection Area would provide funds to study those questions and dig into the details and understand and try to understand better what water resources are available for the community on the West Plains.
Are there priorities when it comes to West Plains if there was an aquifer protection area that you'd want to study first?
It's a great question. We haven't had funding to study the aquifers on the West Plains for a number of years. We did quite a bit of work in the early 2000s for watershed planning, and there was a lot of look at water quantity. And that is, we'd want to look at water quantity, both groundwater and surface water. Some of the surface water that when it transitions from underground to above ground, there's places where we can see that happening and we could understand that better. The big topic right now in the community for the West Plains is PFAS contamination. So I suspect we would use some of the funding towards PFAS. But generally, we don't have a specific plan of how we want to use this. We want to have funding available to put together a plan, work with the cities on the West Plains to work with them to see what their priorities are. Those big picture questions of how much water is there and of what quality is it are the questions we're looking to answer.
Who would physically do the work? Would you contract with private companies, or does the county have the ability to do that?
So the county has staff that have been doing aquifer protection activities in the Spokane Valley and North Spokane for a number of years. So we have staff that can do that. We likely would hire probably another person, or a person would have a lot of their attention focused on the West Plains. But we can also use the funds to hire a contractor to, for example, put in a monitoring well where there was no information about what the groundwater is. In that case, we could hire a contractor to do that. We can also use these funds to supplement or use as a match for grant funding. So we might be able to use these funds from the aquifer protection area to apply for a grant to do a larger study. And that could be county staff. It could also be city staff. Maybe the cities on the West Plains might have some interest in studying their water supply that they use for their city. They could use those funds. So it could be a range. At this point, I think we would have county staff do the initial planning and have a county staff member available to focus on the West Plains.
Would this have happened without the PFAS discovery, do you think?
I don't know. I think there has been a lot of focus on West Plains water in recent years. There's been
Because of growth, because of
water availability. There's been places where the water levels have dropped significantly and cities have had to change how they get their water. There's been expansion of water supply from the city of Spokane up onto the West Plains. There has been areas of high water tables. So there's places where there's too much water where it shows up on the surface, and this would be funds that could be available to use to study those and hopefully come up with solutions for the community.
So let's take a step back for the Spokane-Rathdrum Prairie aquifer area. Tell me about how you think that's been beneficial over the years.
A few things. It's created a long-term database of how the water is doing in the Spokane Valley aquifer. So it's tracked both water level. It's tracked, is water level declining? And generally, it's not in the Spokane-Valley-Rathdrum Prairie aquifer. And then it's tracked water quality. And one of the big projects, Spokane County, and partnered with the city of Spokane for septic tank elimination program, where we eliminated on-site wastewater disposal. And this aquifer protection area created a database and collected samples to see whether or not that work was effective. And we found that it was effective. There are areas where water quality is declining in the Spokane Valley aquifer, and so we're keeping track of those. And then the other pieces, we've had an opportunity to provide a lot of education. So we meet with students and explain how water resources, the water right under their ground, under their feet, is important, and how their activities on the surface can impact or damage their groundwater beneath their feet. And so that's created that where we meet with students, adults is that'll come through, and they recall having aquifer education. They understand that the groundwater that they use in their home comes from underneath their feet, and there's a good recognition of that. And so that's been effective too.
So in the West Plains, the aquifer protection area, would that be separate from PFAS and what to do with PFAS, or is it kind of all together?
It's kind of all together. So PFAS is the big contaminant that we're very concerned about right now, and there's a lot of activity towards that. But the aquifer protection area, this one is proposed to be for 20 years. And so the fee would be stable. It wouldn't increase over time. It would be collected over that 20 years. And so right now there's a lot of attention on PFAS. But 20 years from now, I don't know what the attention will be. And so this is a very predictable fund for the county and the cities to use and answer questions. So when questions today, we're talking about PFAS. In the future, we may be talking about something else. I think it will be a blend of all of that.
Do you think it'd be feasible that once you start collecting information, that will help you to determine how are we going to attack the PFAS contamination issue?
Yeah, I think so. I think more information is better. And there's a lot of directed activity right now towards PFAS with the Department of Defense and Spokane International Airport and City of Spokane and Spokane County are all doing activities looking at how to provide clean drinking water to homes, how to remediate problem areas. And so more information is useful. And I don't know that this aquifer protection area would be used specifically towards remediating the PFAS issue. There's other players in that, and maybe that would take the lead. But there are questions. People are concerned about development causing declining water levels. And so we can start to better understand that. But I think more information throughout the area would help inform all of the decisions that we make for water resources there.
So in terms of the specifics of how much people would pay if the area is created, what are you telling people right now?
Yeah, so the fee, the aquifer protection area fee, is set up for people. If you use water at your home, you're charged an aquifer protection area fee, and that's for a single family residence is $15 per year. And if you are also dispose of your wastewater through on-site septic system, that's another $15 per year. So a rural home that's on a private well and a septic system would pay $30 per year. If you're in a area that has centralized sewer, so a public sewer, you don't pay the fee for the septic system. So you still use water, so you'd still pay $15 for a single family residence, but you wouldn't pay the septic fee for on-site wastewater disposal. So it's somewhere between $30 and $15. For a single family residence, a duplex pays twice that, and businesses and multifamily facilities are charged based upon water meter size. And so there's a way to make them somewhat equivalent to what the charges are for a single family residence.
Is that equivalent for Spokane with the Spokane-Rathdrum Prairie aquifer charges as well?
Yes, exactly. So it's the fees are the same fees that we have been using for the Spokane Valley Rathdrum Prairie Aquifer. We talked with the cities on the West Plains about what the fee structure could look like, and we used that example of what has been in place for 41 years on the Spokane Valley Rathdrum Prairie Aquifer, and the fees have been constant through that time, and so we think it is reasonable to use that same fee to the West Plains and collect that money that way.
Ben Bradabo is the Water Programs Administrator for Spokane County. Bradabo alluded to a variety of other activities related to PFAS, from supplying homes with clean water to tracking the pollutants. There's a lot going on. We asked Erica Berezovoy from the Department of Ecology's Toxics Cleanup Program to help us keep track of that activity. Ecology is the regulatory agency with oversight over PFAS-related issues. She began with the work done by Fairchild Air Force Base.
At Fairchild, they've been working on it since 2017, and they have provided whole house treatment systems to 92 highly impacted homes in their monitoring area. And they're working on 7 more. They will continue testing wells in the area, and they're expanding their sampling area in August 2028. And that's in response to the EPA setting the drinking water standards for PFAS.
Now, I understand you're not part of Fairchild, but Fairchild has a public committee, or at least a committee that people can monitor to understand what's going on at Fairchild. Is that correct?
Correct. That's the Restoration Advisory Board, and they have public meetings. They had one back in April, and the next one isn't scheduled, but I believe it'll be in fall or winter.
Tell me a little bit about what Ecology has determined in terms of the responsible parties, Spokane City and County.
Right. So we have set what we're calling the Emergency Interim Action Area. It's the area that we believe is separate from contamination that is from Fairchild. And we have different data sources that have shown us, kind of delineated that area. It'll never be perfect, but it's our best judgment right now. And our main focus is getting clean water for those people that are north and east of the airport.
In fact, there was an event there, I think, over the weekend, was there not?
Yeah, on Saturday, the city and the county and the airport were out at the waste-to-energy facility, and they were handing out PFAS water filter pitchers and then also food-grade water containers that people can use at the Garden Springs fill station.
So what's Ecology's authority over not only the city and county, but also Spokane International Airport? You're kind of the overseer of all that?
We are. So Washington's law is the Model Toxics Control Act. That's our environmental cleanup law. And so it's Ecology's job to put that regulation into play. In 2023, we were given results that showed that the airport had found PFAS in the groundwater on their property. And so at that point in time, we started the cleanup process.
The city and the county have submitted their plans for, I guess, proceeding there. Can you tell me a little bit more about the amount of time that is open still when it comes to the comment period, and you've got a meeting coming up in a few weeks. Is that correct?
That is correct. We have a public comment period on the short-term plan to provide safe water. And basically, they've already started implementing that plan because we are kind of in an emergency state to get people clean water as quickly as possible. So even though the comment period is open until June 30th, we're the work is underway. We do have a public meeting on June 16th. That's a Tuesday at 6 p.m. That'll be at Shriners Event Center. And we'll be talking more about the short-term work plan. We'll provide an update on the investigation, answer people's questions, and people can submit written comments at that time.
After that comment period ends at the end of June, what happens then?
So after that, we review everyone's comments and we respond to all the comments, and then we post our response to comments, and we also share it with the responsible parties. And so we really do want to know how people feel that this initial effort is going, and maybe we can help implement things that would improve the process.
Can Ecology help to tweak those plans and say it's great here, but it's not sufficient there?
We did do that initially. The document, which is called the Short-Term Interim Action Work Plan, went through some review cycles, and we did provide comments. And some of those comments were implemented in the document, and some were not. So we're trying to work through that and get the best outcome for everyone.
I think Ecology has also been soliciting public comment throughout the period. I think I read those in some of your documents there. What sorts of things are you hearing right now from folks who are up there?
some of the main concerns have been people wanting water for all of the uses that they would normally do at their home. And these are, many of these are rural properties. So people want clean water for gardening. They want it for their livestock. They want it for their pets. You know, it's not just about drinking water.
Do you sense that there's, I guess, a sense of frustration by people out there maybe being lightening up a little bit now that action is being taken by some of the responsible parties?
I think that people are probably relieved to see something happening, but there is still angst over those same things because we don't have clear answers yet or a clear timeline of when people are going to be made whole, as a lot of them put it.
So there's also a fire station up there that has had some PFAS contamination. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, we are working with them. We did some soil sampling out there and we're planning some soil sampling out there. We did some groundwater sampling, which let us know that there was an issue we thought that was coming from the fire station itself. And that's when we listed them as a cleanup site. But yeah, we're getting a contract done to do some soil sampling there. So hopefully we can maybe figure out a hot spot in the soil or something and get that removed.
Do you anticipate this is going to be a long-term sort of thing, that ecology will be involved in this for years rather than just months?
Oh, absolutely. All cleanups generally take years, and PFAS is so long-lasting in the environment that this will definitely take some time.
What is ecology learning from other parts of the country who are also dealing with PFAS? Is this one of these things that we can actually learn from each other about what works here and what doesn't work there?
Oh, absolutely. Many states are working on different topics, especially gardening and how different plants uptake PFAS, and also animals and livestock and, you know, food, or, you know, animals that people raise so that they can eat them, and how that gets into the meat and the vegetables. And our Washington Department of Health, we partner with them closely on all these issues, and they are actually working on that stuff. And they have taken samples of livestock and eggs out in the West Plains. They are looking for funding to do also some home-raised vegetables and fruits testing.
That's Erica Berezovoy, the Public Involvement Coordinator from the Washington Department of Ecology's Toxics Cleanup Program in Spokane. We finish our PFAS segment by checking in with John Hancock, the director of the West Plains Water Coalition. He says the city providing clean water to residents with contaminated wells is one small step forward, but only a small step.
It's an example of how the airport and its co-responsible parties, the city and the county, are trying to solve an extraordinarily troublesome, brand new, never before problem with existing ideas and existing mechanisms and existing money.
What would be a better way to do it?
For all of these leaders who have a stake in the problem to get together to say, we've got to come up with some new plans, some new methods, some new affiliations, some new ideas, and we've got to figure out how to get around the regulations that give us the excuse not to help. The politicians are more brave to speak up about this now because they aren't alone. So it's not just a problem for one organization, it's a problem for many. And you could say about the coalition that when this all began in 2017, there were a whole lot of agencies and organizations that decided to hide in the weeds rather than acknowledging the problem. And they all wanted it to be somebody else's fault. But it's not somebody else's fault. It's everybody's duty. So you could say the coalition has mowed the yard, mowed down the weeds, and left the agencies all standing there in their drawers looking around to say, who's going to help us? And how can we get out of this? And whose money, like money from the manufacturers, whose money is actually going to pay for the problem in the long run? It's now a necessity, I think, for previously rival organizations like the cities and the county to get together to collaborate and to learn how to listen to people from the community who are affected in new ways. That's not just your duty to listen. It's that in a sincere way, the affected people in the country are receiving care, not just services, but we count. We taxpayers count. And I find the rationale for that in the county's own mission statement, which has two parts. On the first page of the county's website, it says the mission of Spokane County is economic opportunity and quality of life. And what I say is those two goals are out of whack. the quality of life has been sacrificed to growth. And we've got to get those two good things back into a new balance. And we'll use PFAS to figure out how to do that.
So the coalition is working hard to elevate the level of the visibility of this issue. How well are you doing?
We've got 500 members. We distribute a PFAS weekly newsletter frequently. What we now feel like hundreds of affected people have learned enough of PFAS to be confident in telling their own story in the larger context. It's not just me speaking out. It's now people everywhere in all kind of venues speaking up for this idea that, this is me. This is not those guys over there. This is not just a newspaper headline. This is the lived experience every day with a faucet in my house that I can't drink.
That's John Hancock from the West Plains Water Coalition. This week, Providence Sacred Heart announced it is changing which of its employees will see emergency room patients who need mental health screenings. Providence says the goal is to improve services to those people. Those changes will take effect in mid-July. We called Tamara Sheehan, the provider's senior director of behavioral health in Spokane, and I asked her about a quote attributed to the company's chief executive in a press release.
Susan Stacy's quoted as saying, "Behavioral health needs in our community have changed, and it's our responsibility to adapt." How have they changed?
I think in a couple of different ways. First, you know, in the emergency room, when people first are having initial presentations in the emergency room, we have an increase in the serious mental illness, as well as increase in the substance use, not only in the acuity of the patients compared to 10 years ago or longer, also in the age groups as well. You know, we're starting to see people with serious mental illness that have suffered from those illnesses or substance use for many, many years. And so we're seeing medically fragile, more elderly individuals, which actually rolls into what we're seeing in our inpatient psychiatric units, which is, you know, people who, again, more medically acute than they ever have been. They're aging. They just need more direct hands-on patient care compared to years before when we had a lot less acuity.
For somebody who walks into the hospital right now, maybe the emergency room or what, tell me what the procedure is right now, and does that change under the new regime?
Yeah, I would say that no processes or protocols are changing. So everything should look seamless to the patients who walk into our doors. People are in our emergency room in a lot of different ways, whether it be they bring themselves in, family brings them in, police, ambulance. And maybe it's for a mental health or substance use issue, or maybe it's for a medical issue. And then we end up evaluating based on some of their answers to some of our routine questions around, you know, depression and suicidal thoughts. And then once our emergency room attending physicians or ARMPs complete their assessment, both medical and work to address those issues, they may determine that their patient needs another evaluation, further evaluation around their mental health and the severity of whether they're safe to go home, whether maybe they need to be evaluated by a psychiatrist, or they're for sure somebody who is willing or unwilling to stay to receive inpatient psychiatric care. So none of that changes. That's exactly the same process that we've always had in place. What changes is just now we're having people who are trained in the emergency room. They've had the education, they can diagnose, they can create treatment plans based on those diagnostics and provide accurate, you know, recommendations to partner with the ED physician in a more educated way than we have before.
So are the people who are going to be doing this work, is it a much more extensive education sort of that they need, or what's the difference between for the preparation between the people who are doing that work now and who will do it in a couple of months?
There was a variety of levels of past education for the individuals that were in that are currently in the department. But yes, there's much more education involved with the current group. It will be a mandatory. They have a master's degree in a social science that allows them to get experience and education in the things I talked about, diagnostics and treatment plans and so forth. Because they will, minimum, they have a master's degree from an accredited college. Yeah.
So is Providence having to go out then and find these people? And it's a workforce question. Are there enough people out there to be able to do this work?
That definitely we're going to have to recruit. You know, we're not reducing positions, so we'll be recruiting for the same number of positions that are currently in that department. I guess we'll see. There's people that really love to work in the hospital, and they have those licenses. We actually have the same model of care at Holy Family Hospital in their emergency room, and we've been able to staff that. So, you know, obviously it has to be work people want to do, because hospital emergency room is not for everybody, and they will have to have some experience in crisis. And so they're not going to be fresh out of college. They may work for another organization like Frontier Behavioral Health or, you know, Lutheran Services, other community partners that have had that type of work in the community.
So how does Providence decide how much we need in order to satisfy the demand? Are you worried about that, you know, even by scaling this up, we're still not going to have enough to be able to, you know, satisfy the people who are coming into our doors?
Yeah, what I'd say is that we currently have a model with the number of FTEs and positions that we have, and we meet the needs based on the similar process, just the type of work the current individuals, they cannot perform. They do some of the informational gathering and provide that to the ED physicians who make that determination on next steps for the patient's care. Actually, I think our volumes have remained very steady, and we've been able to meet that demand with that process. Evaluations take a little bit longer in this new model, but not significantly longer than they take now. So I don't think there's going to be a problem with meeting the needs of our emergency room with the people who enter it based on this model of change.
So beyond the Providence system, is this something that a lot of other health systems are finding themselves having to do?
Oh, yeah. What I found is I've got partners in Providence and partners outside of Providence within Washington State and Oregon specifically. And I've done reviews of what they do in their emergency rooms. And everybody, this is what we're moving to is industry standard.
And in terms of the amount of resources that Providence is able to, that we'll have to put toward this, is it a significant investment? Is it you're spending the same amount of money in a different way? How is that?
Yeah, well, the new model of care is likely to cost more than we currently have. Yeah, it's this is not a financial savings project that we're doing. This is really just writing the kind of care we need to provide for our patients with the individuals who can do that work.
Okay, then in terms of the personnel, you're communicating with the folks who are going to be affected by this. Can you give me sort of down the line, what's the next few months look like?
We've provided a 60-day notice, so we'll continue business as usual for the individuals. They'll continue to come to work and continue to have their schedule. It would be business as usual for those individuals unless they find another position prior to that 60 days being notice being coming up, and then they would, you know, we would follow our normal processes for that. You know, as we work with them and their unionized individuals and their union, we'll determine what next steps and pathways may be available to them. Obviously, we want to keep them in the Providence family. You know, a lot of these people have had a significant time with us in our organization, and we care about them as people, and we want to hopefully keep them in Providence and try to provide what pathways we can to do so.
Tamara Sheehan is the Senior Director of Behavioral Health for Providence Healthcare in Spokane. Inland Journal is the weekly public affairs program produced at SPR News. It's heard on the radio every Thursday at 12:30 and Saturday at 2:30 or anytime at SpokanePublicRadio.org. One note, someone in the big wide world of the internet has been sending out interview requests to potential guests for Inland Journal. They seem to be targeting authors, asking if they'll come on the show and talk about their writing. And then once the interview happens, they ask the guests to make a financial donation. I'll make it clear, this is not something I or anyone else from SPR is involved in. If you have questions or you get a similar request, contact me at news@kpbx.org. I'm Doug Nadvornik. We'll be back next week with another Inland Journal.